I always try to look for those chronic pain points.
Welcome to this episode of the Marketing Development Podcast. And today I am joined all the way from the States by a gentleman who the universe has had in mind that we should collide at some point, Mr. Jason Resnick. How are you doing, mate?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Really good. So Jason and I seem to say this on like a number of podcasts, but we genuinely have been sort of moving in very similar circles over the last year, 18 months or so. And this is genuinely the first time we've spoken to each other.
Yeah, it's funny because I see your name pop up and I hear other people talking, you know, to you and about you and all of that. And, it's just funny. It's like, okay, so how come we haven't had a conversation yet? So I'm excited for this for sure.
Yeah, you know, I recently recorded a podcast with somebody called Moore Cohen. She runs the design class, and she literally dropped me a messenger message. And the opening messenger message said, "So I was sitting here wondering why Pete hasn't invited me on his podcast."
That's funny.
I thought it was like the best way to open a messenger conversation ever. It was brilliant.
I may have to do that when the next time I try to go on somebody's podcast.
Yeah, it worked. It worked. A podcast went live a week or two ago. Yeah, it was brilliant. So Jason, do you want to sort of just give a quick intro as to who you are and what you do?
Sure. As you said, I'm here in the States. I'm in New York, and I guess better known on the line as Rez, and that's with 3 Z's.
Yeah,
which is sort of has a story of itself. But I'm a web developer. I've trained professionally as that. I went to school for that. I didn't go to school for web development, but I went to school for computer science. Mm-hmm. And I've run my own business full time in August. It will be 9 years. And so I help establish online businesses, specifically e-commerce businesses, get more customers, get repeat customers, and create raving fans. And I do that through email automation, on-site personalization, learning more about who the customer is and their pain points. And a lot of that entails marketing, but it also entails development. And that's the services side of the business. The other side of the business, which is fairly young, it's only about 12, 18 months of me really putting a decent effort into it, is helping other developers and designers essentially do what I do, right? And that is creating a business around the life that they want to design. So I help them figure out what their niche is, figure out how to build recurring revenue, and also, you know, figure out what opportunities that may be in front of them that they're not currently seeing. And I do that through any number of ways. My own podcasts, which I have two, Live in the Feast and Ask Rez. And I have a community called Feast, and I do one-on-one coaching.
So, I mean, it sounds like there's obviously a whole load of stuff there to unpack. And I know from the sort of pre-call chat that we just had that the client work side of things is an important part of what you do, and it keeps you rooted in sort of practices and the processes that you need to go through, and helps you actually serve that other side of your audience quite well. So, there's a load of people out there that move away from client work, but it's definitely part of who you are.
Yeah. I mean, for me, for one, I love my clients. I've worked hard to build the relationships that I have with my clients, some of which are going on years now, month over month over month. And so, for me, I enjoy working with them and the kinds of businesses that they run and helping them grow. And for me, if I'm going to be an effective mentor, coach, community leader, whatever it is that you want to call what I do for helping other developers and designers, and just to be able to provide information that I know works, at least on, in my world, and what doesn't work in my world. And because, you know, and a mutual friend of ours, Chris Tucker, he always says, you know, like, you're going to attract the people that you want into your ecosystem and repel the other people. And so those people that listen to my podcast, you know, join me for one-on-one coaching, even, you know, they, there's something about me that they can connect to, and I want to be able to help them the best way possible. And in order for me to do that, I still need to be doing what I'm teaching.
Yeah, I fully agree. And I think, I know that this was the conversation we basically had before, particularly when you're in a development niche, that's the background I come from. And the way that the technology and the infrastructure and all that kind of stuff changes at such a pace that if you're not actually actively doing it, it's very easy to get behind the curve on that. And with you then trying to develop a side of your business that relates to those developers as well, you need, that's their language. You need to be talking that language to relate to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I kind of toe the line a little bit is between business and tech. It's always kind of been like my unique sweet spot. Even when I worked full time, you know, my directors and higher ups would say, look, you're a geek, but you can actually speak English, you know, and you can, like, I can tell you things and you could translate them for me. And so, yes, I am deeply rooted in code. That's where I love to be a lot of times. But what I do for my clients is a lot of marketing too. So both of those change so fast, so quickly. Things that worked yesterday will not work today. And so, you know, if I'm not doing that, then, you know, I feel that I'll become stale and I won't become as relevant as I possibly could. Yes, what I teach has some method and old school business roots to it. But to be able to, like you said, talk the language that developers and designers are talking, I have to know what they're talking about to even have a conversation sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I was a junior dev, one of the things that kind of helped me work my way up the slippery slope of management in agencies was I worked at this agency in Sheffield, which is where we live. And the creative director, I remember the first time I ever met him, he was sort of above the tactical delivery of projects. You know, he was one of these conceptual guys, and he had the floppy frilly shirt cuffs that went on and all of this. He sort of breezed in and he sort of, you know, noticed me out the corner of his eye, and that was about all I got. And over the first kind of 4, 5, 6 months I was working there, all of a sudden we started to have a few conversations. And I remember having one specific conversation with him, which says, you're different because I can put you in front of a client.
Exactly.
And that was one of the things that actually made me move away from development a little bit into project management, and then into senior management, and then into directorship, and you know, the sort of the rest is history. But some devs are brilliant, absolutely brilliant at what they do, but what they want to do is lock themselves in a room and do nothing but code all day. And from a career perspective, if that's what you want to do, that's great, but it's going to have a bit of a ceiling on it. You're only going to go so far. And then there's other people that are sort of, I'm trying to avoid using the word presentable quite quickly, but do you know what I mean? That can talk real world language as well as talk code. And in terms of sort of growing businesses, that's kind of where you need to be. You need to be able to relate to people as well as relate to other devs. And that's such an important point. And I guess that's one of the things that you're picking up on with the work that you're doing with designers and devs to help them grow their business.
Yeah, I mean, a similar path that you had was that, you know, I worked for a consultant firm in the early 2000s that put a lot of their eggs, so to speak, into the startup boom, right? Mm. And, you know, they noticed that, you know, I was running a dev team. And, you know, I was a senior developer, and they just put me in a position, and it was ridiculous growth in this. I mean, I only worked for them for 2.5 years, and I started there at like employee number 600. We grew to about 2,400. And then by the time I was laid off, there was like 400 people. right? So right. It was like ridiculous. And that's what happened to me. They said, hey, you can be a sales engineer. And I was, I was in my early 20s and I was like, okay, I don't even know what that means, but sure. And they basically said, that means you could sit in on sales meetings and add technical input.
Yeah.
And have a conversation with people that, business owners and marketing folk and sales people, and have a conversation that they can ask a question and the salesperson doesn't have to say, let me talk to my dev team. The dev team is sitting right next to me. And so I didn't realize it then, but that was a skill that, I guess I just had. And I look back on it now where I try to, talk. I encounter a lot of those devs that just want to sit behind a keyboard and they don't want to talk to anybody. And yet at the same time, they have aspirations of whether it is building a SaaS product or building an agency or whatever it could be. I say, well, you have to at least somewhat figure out a way to leverage your skill set to do the other things that you don't want to do. Right. And so that's what I had to do early on when I started my own business was, how do I leverage my skill set to do sales? How do I leverage my skill set to do marketing? Because I'm not going to sit there with a phone on my desk and just keep dialing from a call sheet. I will never do that. And I will never walk door to door knocking on doors. It's just, one, it's not my nature. And two, it's just not who I am. Like, it's not who I want to be. And so I just thought of other creative ways that I could, leverage my development skill set and say, hey, maybe I could just key in on, set up some script or automation to key in on certain keywords that I hear on Twitter and or see that come up on Craigslist even. Mm-hmm. And then ping me as soon as these things hit. And if it's interesting enough, I bounce into it and see if it's an opportunity that I can jump in on. But and I try to help other devs and designers navigate that and try to say, look, embrace your skill set. And if you really want to build a business that is sustainable, you're going to have to do these other things.
Yeah.
Word of mouth only works, happenstance word of mouth only works for so long, where then you have to turn that around and say, okay, I actually have to go out and do sales and marketing.
Yeah, you're dead right. There's two things. This is becoming quite a freaky call. So if you're listening to this and this sounds like you're listening to two people who are like looking in the mirror, then I apologize. So the first thing is that you mentioned, obviously you work with e-commerce clients. So the last agency I worked in before I set up this company was an e-commerce agency. And I'm fully aware that business owners that come into, that have e-commerce requirements, particularly on a large scale, they already have their own way of doing things, and they don't want a website developer to come in and tell them that they have to change the way they want to do it. They just want, they want it to work the way that they already have it, but they want it to work online or work better online. So you've got to sort of think on your feet in terms of think a bit laterally about the tools you've got and the way that the systems can integrate and all that kind of stuff, so that in order to delight the client, he actually doesn't really care how the code works. He mm-hmm. just knows that this is the way my process is. My family's done it like this for 57 years. I now need a website and I want to still do it like this, just with a website on top. So, that when you said that, I'm sitting here smirking, thinking I've had those conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a definite, it's funny when people ask for my sales scripts, because, obviously developers are very tactful and very detailed oriented. And I say, I don't have one. It's just a lot of thinking on my feet. It's a lot of, just my experience tells me that we can swing the conversation one way or the other. And it's just an intuition that I have sometimes. And so, it's funny. I've had many of those conversations and I like to call them the dance, right? Because it's like, okay, yes, I want to help you get to where you want to get to. And I know you want to get to the same place. We're on the same page here. So from my experience, it tells me that if we do these couple of things, we can get there. It's going to take time or whatever. And I kind of scope that out for them. But then I say, we can do it your way as well. It may take longer, may not work. I don't know. I've never tried it that way or whatever. And so I try to work in a collaborative effort with anybody that I work with, because ultimately it's the same. We want to get to the same place. We're not trying to fight each other. But that you have to have that empathy. You have to realize that it's their business. You don't own it. Yes, your experience may tell you something that works, but be open to their experience as well. And if it's worked for them for years, it's worked for a reason. Maybe there is a way that we can do what you want to do online. And so I always try to always embrace those perspectives. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But having that handshake and saying, hey, yes, we're on the same page and let's move forward together. That's it. Whatever happens at the end, that initial conversation, somebody's right and somebody's wrong. But then at that point in time, the other person realizes it once you get to that destination.
Yeah.
And that trust factor just even increases at that point.
Yeah, yeah, too right. And then the second, because I did have two things. The second thing that you said was that you then said that you've got an automation set up, kind of watching hashtags or whatever on Twitter. And the really weird thing about that is I have a very similar thing set up, watching hashtags on LinkedIn. But you're dead right. The process of finding new work, if that's all you focus, you know, people have business development people, and that's entirely what they do, full-time job. If you are a freelancer or you're a small scale agency where you've got to wear multiple hats, and therefore having some of these processes in place that actually take some of the legwork out for you is the it's the way to do it. It just gives you back more time. And I think one of the really key things is people undervalue the time that they have, particularly when people are starting out. You know, it seems like time is cheap, where actually time is one of the most valuable currencies we have.
Absolutely. And a lot of times it's like, well, it only takes me 5 minutes. Well, that 5 minutes adds up pretty quickly if it's on a daily basis.
Yep.
And, you know, if I said to you, hey, if I just walked up to you and I said, hey, if I can give you a half hour back each day to do whatever you want, would you do it? Of course you would. Mm-hmm. But if I said, if I just saved you 5 minutes today, you'd probably say no. But if that's a daily 5 minutes and I can give you something back to give you a half hour out of that week, you're going to take me up on that every single day. So I always try to think about, okay, if I've done the same thing two or three times in a row, and especially online nowadays, I mean, when I first started, it was me writing scripts, right? Because there weren't these nice little tools like Zapier and Integromat and IFTTT that kind of connect all these apps in the world together. If they don't already talk to each other, it's like, okay, if I've clicked around on the screen a couple of times in a couple of different apps and cut and pasted from here and there, then how can I do this? Like, how can I automate this? Because I don't want to keep doing this every single day or every single week or every single month. And it's just little things like that that go a long way to building yourself in a sustainable way.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to sort of move on in a second, but just if you sort of relate to anything that Jason's just said there, there was an episode we did with Jimmy Rose, who I also know you know, a few episodes back, where he talks about how to become time positive. And, you know, if you do have these tasks that take up, you know, 5 minutes a day or 5 minutes a week, whatever it is, if you invest an hour now to automate that within, 20 weeks, you'll all of a sudden start being time positive. But if you can do that for multiple things every week, then you know what, you start becoming time positive a heck of a lot quicker. And of course, Jimmy's developing a course about all of this, which I'll drop a link in the show notes just to give him some kudos, because he's working really hard on it. I know that at the moment. So where, just right, that's kind of like the end of the intro, which I'm aware we're like 16 minutes in. So, one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about was the whole process and the whole sort of identification of recurring revenue streams. Because I know that's something that you work with your membership and with your sort of freelancers, your designers, your developers community that you've got there. And there's so many advantages to developing recurring streams of income, not just for cash flow, but also, you know, if purely based on project work, you're basically as good as the last project you sent out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's your take on that? Where do you start with constructing recurring revenue products?
Yeah. First things first is everybody thinks that it's the holy grail, right? Like, I could build recurring revenue. That's great. I get money in every single month for doing nothing. That's not the case. Yeah. I always call it, because the thing is, there's a couple of things that are I want to mention here for semantics, right? There's recurring revenue, there's predictable revenue. In my world, that's the same.
Yeah.
Right? Recurring revenue usually aligns itself with SaaS or some digital product that you know you can, if you put in X, you're going to get out Y. And for me, in the services world, it's I'm a solo owner, right? I do everything. I wear all those hats. So I only need a handful of clients to keep me sustainable and live the life that, you know, supports me and my family. And so I just want to be able to create predictable income every single month that covers my expenses, covers my savings, and allows me some spending money. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at it from perspective, if somebody came to me first and they're a developer or they're a designer or they're a marketer, I say, what kind of projects are you working on now? What kind of projects do you like working on? What kind of people do you like to work with? And then the opposite of all of that. The reason why I have this conversation is it took me a while to figure out that you do have to specialize in some way. If you are doing everything for everybody, it's going to be hard to identify how to create a predictable income stream.
Yep.
Because you have to have, in a predictable income stream, you have to have inputs. You have to know how long it is going to take you to put all those inputs together to get that one output. And yep. So with these sort of questions, and I have a whole framework, it's basically, on my podcast, I explained it all out and you can go find out more because I talk about this tons. This is the step one for me. I talk about it on my website a lot, is that you ask yourself these questions. Who do I like to work with? Why do I like to work with them? And then the opposite as well. And what kind of projects do I like to work on? Why do I like to work on them? What's interesting about them? Those kind of things. And then the opposite. And what you have when you do that is essentially a list. And you could kind of look at the ones that are the positives and say, okay, there's some commonalities here. Like maybe it is all nonprofits. Maybe it is because they're women-owned businesses. Yep. You know, it could be anything of that nature. Or it could be really specific, like, hey, I like to work on this technology stack or whatever. But on the other side is that you're going to have your red flags list. And and that's going to allow you to filter out some of those people that may be appealing as a client, but yet they don't tick all the boxes. And you could say, look, yeah, I just happen to like all nonprofits that are run by women.
Yeah.
And that's what I like to do. And if it's a e-commerce store that, you know, has a lot of money and they're ready to go, and maybe you've even bought from them, you're a customer of them, and it excites you to be able to work on that project, but they don't tick off those boxes, maybe they're not a good fit. Mm. And so then once you have that, it's a matter of trying to figure out what problems you solve for them. And when you figure out what problems you're solving, I always try to look for those chronic pain points, things that may come up every so often, every month, maybe seasonal, especially in the e-commerce space, you have holiday sales, you have end of year sales, you have all these other things that everybody knows that's coming up. But then there's also the daily things that you can do. You know, how do you take a non-customer to become a customer? And that's what I do. It could even be that I'm working you know, there's somebody in my group coaching program, actually, that he loves to code on APIs. And we went through this exercise and he found a specific API and he reached out to that company. And now that company is referring him custom work because they're not going to do the custom stuff. They're just working on their own product, right? And so he's found a little niche there where he gets work in that way. And so it's a matter of really just looking at opportunities that are in front of you that you're already working on and solving and narrowing that focus down to a specific input and output that you can deliver on. And if you could deliver on it on a consistent basis, that's where that predictable income is going to come in.
Yeah. And you know, there's so much you've said there that is so valuable. And you know, there's a lot of times when we're working on project work and we come across new clients, you know, we if we're not a great fit, then actually, you know, you grit your teeth, you get through it. It's 6-8 weeks. Anybody can kind of get through that. We get the project out the door, you learn from it, you move on. If you've got a recurring client, they ain't going away anytime soon,
right?
And if they are going to go away, it's only going to end badly for one or both of you.
Right.
So having that filtration process that you really do only want to be starting to work with people that you A, know that you can get on with, and B, that you know you can actually serve properly. And yeah, I'd fully take your point as well. You know, people do think, right, invoices will go out on the first of the month, they'll get paid 10 days later. Hey, I'm getting paid for nothing. Well, it's not that. If you then want to go and take a holiday and you've got 70 hours of workbooks, you've still got to get that 70 hours of work in. Mm-hmm. Because you're contracted to do it. That's the deal. The payback for that is the predictability of the income, the hopefully the not chasing invoices, the ease of doing your taxes and all that kind of stuff, because it does make those things so much easier.
Yeah.
So where, you know, just from a sort of practical point of view, then I take it, you know, you have your own sort of invoicing software set up, things, all that kind of stuff happens automatically. You have your, you know, you onboard a client. This is the way we work. This is the way that we're going to report back to you what we're doing. This is the way that you're going to lodge tasks with us so that we have a task list, et cetera, et cetera. And you have that whole sort of ecosystem figured out.
Yeah, absolutely. And by knowing how my clients are and what they expect and how I can deliver it allows me to build those systems. As a generalist, I was a generalist web developer for almost 2 years when I first started. And to be frank, this is my second time trying to run a business of myself. And the first time was in the early 2000s after I got laid off from that consultancy firm.
Yep.
And I didn't know a lot of the other things, the marketing, the sales, and all the rest of it. And I was very much a generalist. And after 2 years, I said, well, I have to pay rent and I have to eat. And so I went and got a full-time job. But I knew that I wanted to have my own business. I wanted that time freedom. And what I wound up doing was learning all the things that I possibly can about sales, marketing, and all the rest of it. And this time around, while I learned all that, the first couple of years there, I was still very generalist. And I was like, I can't, how do I have a process? I don't know what the client is going to ask. I don't know what I'm going to be doing for the client. I can't schedule out projects because I don't know when a project is specifically going to end. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things. And so after getting burned out and I got engaged, and then a month later I had to swallow my pride and tell my soon to be wife that I had to go back and maybe this isn't for me. Like a lifelong dream of mine since I was 14 years old is not going to work out. And she, you know, she's the rock and like, she wants to know where everything is coming from. She said, well, we'll figure it out. Cause I know that that's not what you want. I was like, oh, then I have to figure this out. Right. And so what I did was I did that self-reflection of the business, myself, and all the rest of it. And those processes that came out of that, once I figured out what it was I just had conversations with my ideal clients. And those ideal clients told me that, one, they wanted a weekly phone call, which I didn't even realize, but I charged for that. That's something that they wanted on a recurring basis. Mm-hmm. they wanted to communicate through email. They didn't want to log into Basecamp or any of these other help desk tools and keep track of tickets or all the rest of it. They were in email. They understood email and they just wanted that set up. So, okay, I can use something like Help Scout, right? Set up an email address while on the back end of I take that Help Scout ticket and I put it into my project management system and I do what I need to do, but the communication is through Help Scout. It's not through a ticketing system or a knowledge base or anything like that. And so just having these certain conversations, I figured out, okay, this is how I can deliver this. And like you said, onboarding, as soon as somebody goes through my project application as a prospect, and if we decide to work together and become a client, and they become a client of mine, then they immediately start getting several emails in the first day, one thing per email that I need from them. And they go, that first sequence of onboarding goes over the course of 24 days where they get emails at certain intervals from things that I need, me just saying, hey, we've been working together for a little while. Do you have any questions for me? Things of that nature to try to onboard them and create that experience for them that I know that because I have a history of working with others that they may have things that they need too. So I try not to assume things, but there's, because I've worked with the same kind of clients and the same kind of projects, I know what I need. I know what I don't need. And I have these systems and processes built all around that as best as I can.
You know, you've hit on something that is so simple but so genius there, because you've said that your clients like to communicate by email, and then in your onboarding process you then send them one thing per email, and it is so easy for people to think, right, a new client, okay, and then you end up writing an email that's like Ben Hur, you know, that tells them everything about you, everything about your business, everything that you're going to need from them, everything that they want from you, all this kind of stuff. And actually then when the client is, you know, 24 hours later thinking, I need to get Jason those FTP details. Mm-hmm. If they can just search their email for Jason FTP and hey, bang, there's the email that comes up, because that's all that's in it. You know, that's just client side proof that this process helps them as well as helping you. And I guess that's where a process really, really kind of comes into its own, where they really work is when they serve you and they serve your clients in equal measure or greater measure on one side, on the client side, or however that analogy works. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I mean, 100%. I mean, it's got to be a win-win for both. And like I said earlier on, we're both on the same page with the same objective. So, as you said, if I write a long email that's asking them for Google Analytics, their website details, create an admin for me in Google Analytics, and this is how you do it, and I also need your ConvertKit or Drip account information. Like, if I give them this laundry list and they don't know one of those things, they're not going to send me anything. Yeah. And I've just learned that from experience. And to say, okay, I have a website and it's titled Your Website Details and Your ConvertKit Details. Here's how you create a Google Analytics user so that I can get in there. All of these things as single emails, and these are things that I know I need. And so if they don't send me any of that information because they don't know how to do one of those things, that's a problem for me, and that holds up the works. And so I just ask these things one at a time. I just learn from experience and who I work with, and I try to value their time. Like, a lot of people sometimes, they just only have 2 minutes and, oh yeah, let me get that website, information over to Jason, because they see that and they know it only takes 2 minutes to do.
Yep.
And so I try to respect that, and I just kind of drip feed that email out. And quite frankly, I started it out by setting up canned messages in my Gmail. Now I have an automation that goes out of ConvertKit, I started it out very cut and paste like,
yep.
But after a while and knowing that it works, then you can put the automation on it, and it just happens for me.
The other thing, we're kind of touching on it with this, and you mentioned your weekly phone calls. I think the other thing that people seriously underestimate with retained services, and I should clarify, by retained services, I'm not talking about kind of low value things like hosting, because they just sort of happen. I am I'm talking about actual what you'd normally be doing as kind of a project type service, like design or development or copywriting or SEO or I don't know PPC, whatever it might be. Those kind of services, I think people seriously underestimate the communication side of relaying with the client what you're doing, what they, confirming tasks that are coming in from the client, reporting back when those tasks have been done, what the value is that you're adding to their, I don't know, pay-per-click account, whatever it is you're doing, what the value is that's going back, and ultimately demonstrating the worth that, you know what, you're giving me $1,500 a month, you're giving me £2,000 a month, whatever it is, and this is what you're getting back for it. Because otherwise, what will happen after a number of months of lack of communication in those areas is somebody will get a bill on the first of the month and say, what the hell are we paying this person for? You know,
right.
Who's heard from Jason in the last 3 months?
Right. And what it does is, it does two things actually. Is one, I didn't even know that they wanted this thing. Right? It was just through conversations, and it was just a 10-minute conversation where I had asked them three questions. How business is going, because every business owner loves talking about their business. Two, it's, just curious why you enjoy working with me. And three, how can I be more awesome? And that's just my language for what can I do for you better? Mm. And what I found on that third question was that while they got a weekly status email from me of the bullet list of the things that we did and what's coming up next week, and overarching strategy on bigger projects and things of that nature, they still wanted that touch point, that phone call or Zoom chat or Skype call or whatever it is. And I was like, okay, that's fine. If I keep hearing this thing, I personally didn't want to do that. So I created a level of service that compensated me accordingly. Yeah. Right. And so if people were willing to pay that extra for the same services that I actually do, but for that extra touch point, then fine. I was willing to carve out a portion of my week, which is usually the end of the week, for half hour phone calls with clients. And I had that booked in and scheduled. And what that did was, one, it appeased their, want to have that connection. But two, it stops all the random phone calls. Mm. Because they know that if on Tuesday, hey, I want to call Jason about this thing that I, talked to my team about yesterday. Well, I'll just talk to him on Thursday now because we have that time set. So I didn't get those interruptions on happenstance. Yep. And we saw, I always used to, I got to stop everything I'm doing to answer this phone call from the client. Now I don't necessarily have that, happen to me because we have these phone calls already.
Yeah. Yeah. We do exactly the same thing in our agency. So, our agency runs about 55-60% on recurring revenue, and the rest is all project work. And, but even with the project work, we scope out, we include weekly calls with the client for exactly that reason. And it's, I know that if any projects I'm in, that the phone calls are either going to happen on a Wednesday afternoon or a Friday morning. And that means that then I know that the rest of the week I can actually get some work done. And it is just that mentality that, people know it's coming. So therefore they make a list and they talk to you about it when you're scheduled in, and it's mm-hmm. good for everybody. I'd be interested on getting your take on this as well. So one of the things we worked hard when we set up the agency to build the streams of recurring income, and we then only made decisions about our company when the recurring income allowed it. So, we're split up. So we needed like another office. So I don't know, mm-hmm. 400 quid a month for the office. We'd only do that when there was enough value in the recurring and that kind of stuff. However, when we were putting our recurring agreements together, we also looked at the exit strategies from both sides. So essentially the offboarding, which isn't what a lot of people talk about these days. Mm-hmm. Sometimes projects are going to come to an end. Even recurring services will come to an end. And sometimes things go wrong. And we wanted to accommodate those in a way that was going to be fair to both sides, that nobody was going to be left out high and dry. And you know what? If somebody did want to move away from us for whatever reason, then this was the process that we could both go through in order to get them their data, get them their code, all that kind of stuff, issue the final bills. I've got to say that's in there as well. And mm-hmm. then, once settled, that's it. Now, thankfully, we haven't had to action that too many times. But have you been through that process as well when you've been setting up your agreements, or have you not come across that bridge yet? I say with a twinkle in my eye.
No, absolutely. You have to think about that, because here's the thing: as somebody, and I've, like I said before, I have clients that have been with me for years, and knock on wood, I don't see them leaving unless I leave. but I've had other clients where, they've stayed on for a number of months, and I fall into a sweet spot where if I get them to where they need to get to with certain projects, they're going to quote unquote graduate, right? Yeah. And I won't be working with them anymore. And yes, I've had those clients, and I always try to, with any recurring service or predictable, how you build your business, there's going to be this knowledge that you accumulate, whether that's code, whether that's, how automations are set up, IP of their business that maybe they're aware of, but they don't know the details on. Mm-hmm. And so what I always try to do is I explain that through the sales process. This is how I work. I document everything. You're going to have basically a live document, a website that'll live on in perpetuity for you. But as I document what I do for you, it's going to live there. And while I would probably say less than 10% of my clients even ever look at that thing, when they do leave, then they start asking about this, and I walk them through all of that. Yeah. And that stuff is built on as an evolving document, if you will. It's simple enough for me to update. It's just not to get into the technical weeds, but it's a markdown document that gets turned into a static website. Yep. And for me, that allows my clients to then have that offboarding meeting where I walk them through what that looks like, how they can find certain things. It's searchable. There's screenshots. It's a pretty in-depth document, if you will, of what I've done for them. And now, while they may look at that immediately after, and I've had a couple of people ask me questions, after we've, disengaged, if you will, and that's totally fine and totally expected too. That's a snapshot in time. It doesn't get evolved anymore. And then they're just going to outgrow it. And I kind of just look at my server stats after a while and see if anybody's even looking at it anymore. but it's something that I've thought about, like yourself. I look at that as like the end. Like, I want my clients to graduate from me. So how does it look like when they do, right? Like, how can I properly give them everything that I have about their business and their projects that I've worked on with them, so that they can then take that and run with it or give that to somebody else?
Yeah, no, it's so important. And I know you've mentioned things like markdown and all of that kind of thing. And I think the point really with that is it's a system that you find easy to use, because you're going to be updating stuff in there on a daily or weekly basis. So it's easy for you to use. And then when you do get to the other end, it's easy for you to output. But that could just as easily be something like Google Docs or, I don't know, an Office 365 cloud document, whatever it might be, just something that's easy for you to use, because you don't want it to be swamping your life. But then on the same note, having that inventory at the end of the thing that says, look, this is what we've done for you, this is how we've done it, shake hands, walk away with your head held high, it makes the ending easier and more professional, let's face it. Just because somebody's a freelancer, just because they're a solo shop, whatever it is, that doesn't mean that you don't need to be professional in the way you approach things.
Yeah, and it goes back to, it's not just easier for me, but it's also something that's simple enough and effective for my clients, right? It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that I know how they want to get things, right? And yes, while I do a lot of Google Docs and Google Sheets and all the rest of it, if I have a simple website, if you will, with a simple URL that they know that they can bookmark and hand it off to somebody else without getting shared access or all that other stuff, it mm-hmm. allows them to then be able to say, oh, okay, this is awesome. And I can even search for, you know, things, and this is great. That's all I need. And it's just, it makes it a win-win for everybody around.
Yeah, I fully agree. Fully agree. Okay, I've got one more question for you. Thank you for your time, because I know we've gone on a little bit longer than we kind of anticipated. Yeah. I've got one more question though, which I've really struggled with, and I haven't yet found a workaround. I'd be really interested to know what your opinion is. So, when we're scoping out projects, a project piece of work, I get the whole value for money thing versus time for money thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you're costing up the project. However, for retained services, I struggle to piece together how you do value-based pricing on a retained service, because what the value is today in 6 months will be completely different, and in 12 months will be different again. So, you know, there's an economy of scale in there, which you don't necessarily have to accommodate when you're looking at project work. So how do you sit on the pricing side of your retained services? Do you do that on a time basis? Do you do that on a value basis? Do you have like a product offering, which is like an a la carte menu that this bit's $100 a month, this bit's $500 a month, and whatever they choose, they put it. How have you constructed your pricing model?
Yeah, my pricing model is really tiered. I have recurring, like yourself, I have one-off projects, which are, and as I said, I've really niched down onto the email marketing and behavioral marketing side of things, especially with the e-commerce space. So I'm close to the bottom line. And so when I've scoped out the types of clients that I work with, I know what I can do. And how valuable it is to them. And then I can price it in a way that makes it a no-brainer for them.
Yeah.
And so I have a tiered service where there's one-off projects, which are kind of, they're for those people that kind of threw up a website and are getting traction and they have nothing.
Yeah. Right?
And so they need to, they're starting to get into the world of, hey, yes, I really want to start doing a lot of this marketing, you know, whether it's email marketing, whether it's, you know, building out onboarding sequences for customers, whatever it could be. And those are one-off projects. And I price those according to basically what the business is telling me about themselves and how I know I can serve them. And I have my prices on my website. And that's something that I always encourage people to do. Because for me, that price anchors not just me against somebody else, because I don't look at it that way. I look at it as, hey, if you have a budget, here's my price. Does it align? And what I can give you on the back end of that in perpetuity, because a lot of what I do is that way. Does it make sense to you?
Yeah.
Right. And so so that tiered pricing is like beginners. And then there's people that are a little bit more advanced, and those are more retainer, where there's a lot of strategy involved. There's a lot of, and I said that I work with e-commerce. I just look at e-commerce as anybody taking a transaction. So while I have people selling physical products, I also have online coaches, I have memberships, I have people that sell digital products, those kind of things too. So I set up, you know, processes like webinar sequences, follow-ups, primers, those kind of things, Facebook interactions with custom audiences, all of that kind of stuff. And so there's a lot of strategy with that, but it's, you know, there's a lot of times where it's napkin math, where I can say on the sales call where they say, hey, your price is $3,500 for this. Like, that seems awfully expensive. I say, okay, let's, you know, I do it in that dance, right? But I basically want to know how many customers they have today, how many customers they get on average, what their price is. And I know how I can affect things on the back end of that with this stuff. And I basically work out some knocking math and say, hey, look, yes, I charge $3,500 for this, but if we do this process and we do it effectively and and we're successful at it, it's going to return to you $30,000.
Yep.
Right.
And I think that's the key thing with one-off projects. It's often seen as a cost. With retained services, I think the discussion, and you've just explained it so really well there, the discussion needs to move from a cost to more of an investment. And that's, you know, an investment has a result, whereas a cost has kind of a product out the other end, in my mind anyway.
But I think even one-off projects, I've always thought that way. Even if I just built a website from scratch, I always looked at it, instead of me comparing an hour, even when I worked hourly, let's say $50 or $100 an hour, I didn't look at it from the perspective of that's just what the market will bear. And obviously there is that factor in there, but I always had that conversation. Even still, I say, hey, you're way expensive than other developers that I have. Sure. Okay. Then let's have a conversation. You don't have an existing website, or your website's just one page that doesn't really do much for you. If we do what we're going to talk about here, I know that it's going to take me 30 hours, which costs whatever it costs, but you're going to have this thing living and working for you as a salesperson that saves you time, increases your profits. And what does that look like? Yep. And so I've always kind of had that sort of mindset to not compare myself to somebody else, meaning a colleague of mine or quote unquote competitor, but really price anchoring myself to the return that the customer is going to get.
Yeah, no, I think that's really insightful. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Jason, thanks again for finding the time. If people want to reach out to you online and find you and you know, have a chat with you about any of this stuff, where's the best place that they can find you?
Yeah, you could go to my website, res.com. That's with 3 Z's, or find me on Twitter. I'm usually there. That's my social media platform of choice, and that's res also.
With 3 Z's.
With 3 Z's.
There'll be links to all of that stuff in the show notes, and the intro and outro I'll tell you exactly where the show notes are. So, mate, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me, Pete.
Take care. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed listening to that as much as I enjoyed recording it. Jason is a really top bloke, and through all of the mutual connections that eventually put us together, I'm so pleased that we managed to make this episode happen. Show notes for this episode can be found at peteeverett.com/067. And in the show notes are links through to Jason's website and his podcast, Living the Feast, and all of that stuff. So please go and check it out. And also come and join us in our Facebook community at peteeverett.com/group, where we talk about all of these topics that we have on the podcast. And you can ask questions in a safe and reliable place to get some sound advice for your business. We'll see you next week.